This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
Well, listen, if there's one thing the history of evolution has taught us, it's that life will not be contained. Life breaks free, it expands to new territories, and it crashes through barriers painfully, maybe even dangerously, but life finds a way.
Welcome, everybody, to Cinematica Animalia, the podcast where we break down the biology of movie monsters. Today, we are doing part one of two episodes on Jurassic Park, the first Jurassic Park movie. As always, the show's broken up into a few different segments. We'll have time codes below, so if you want to skip ahead to certain parts, go for it. Before we get started, my name's Sam Perrin. I'm a freshwater ecologist at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses, alongside co-host number one, Adam Harsick, who is not here today. But with me is co-host number two, Dave, who is a vet and our movie physiologist. So today, we're looking at Jurassic Park. A lot to go through here. Like I said, we're just focusing on the first film because we started off thinking, maybe we'll do the first two. But, I mean, the first film gives us so much to go on. We might have a look at kind of two and three and the new kind of questions they present when Jurassic World Dominion comes out some point in the next 10 years, I guess.
I didn't know that they were actually planning on releasing the third one. Thought they'd just given up after the second.
I'm pretty sure they had started filming and then they've had to push it back. I don't know much about this, but look, we've been lukewarm on the last two, but I'm still up for another one. I'm always up for another one of these.
Fair enough.
Okay, so look, normally we go through and talk about, you know, what happened in the films. If you don't know the plot of Jurassic Park,
I mean, you can do a quick summary.
Okay, fine. We'll do a quick summary. Have you ever had your cat get out of the house?
Yes.
It's that, but with dinosaurs.
Oh, my God.
Look, yeah, okay, fine. You summarize it, Dave.
For anyone listening, the movie has to do with the idea that a group of scientists have managed to collect these samples of dinosaur DNA, and with that, they've managed to clone dinosaurs and grow them to full size in modern day, where they've created a park where they're hoping to bring people to try and see the attractions, pay to see dinosaurs. And surprise, surprise, something goes terribly wrong. And as a common tagline from the movie, life finds a way.
Yeah.
The dinosaurs manage to escape and the films follow the ensuing chaos.
Yes. Fantastic movie.
Amazing.
My dear Dr. Thatcher, welcome to Jurassic Park.
Look, let's just talk about what we think of it. This is incredible.
I mean, this is another one of those films that I think defined so many childhoods.
Yeah.
I used to love watching this with my brother and my dad when I was a kid, although I would have to hide under the blankets whenever the T-Rex was getting too close to the absolutely useless children in the car. And a movie that, as I have gotten older, has aged really, really well.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't spend enough time talking about practical animatronic effects. Those raptors and that T-Rex still look fantastic.
Oh, yeah. And I think we've talked about this before, the horror that was actually on set because of that T-Rex, that enormous T-Rex. Like, people were genuinely in danger because of how clunky and dangerous that thing was.
Yeah.
There was a guy who would have to, like, crawl inside its mouth and, like, fiddle around with stuff. And, I mean, it was the first time they'd done anything of that scale, I'm pretty sure. And that dude's life was in danger.
Yeah.
People talk about the fact that the special effects or the CGI in Jurassic Park is so amazing. But, I mean, it's because there's so little of it. There are a couple of really wide scenes with stuff like, you know, the Brachiosaurus the first time you see it, which is just an incredible first scene, by the way. Like, that introduction to dinosaurs. We've talked about this a bunch recently with Aliens, you know, some of the twists in there. Sigourney Weaver's been asleep for 60 years. We were four. I was four. I think you were four back in 1993.
Yep.
We didn't go to the movies and see this incredible, like, CGI thing for the first time. I would love to just be able to, you know, experience that wonder at seeing this done on the big screen. when that Brachiosaurus just walks onto interview, which, by the way, how did they not notice that earlier? I mean, it's one of the common tropes of all these Jurassic Park movies, just this enormous thing somehow managing to pop up out of nowhere.
And just as because I was rewatching some of this before we did this episode, God, I love a good soundtrack. Like, there's something to be said about the fact that you can start humming the Jurassic Park theme music with a group of people our age, and people will start humming it back, and suddenly you'll have a room of people humming the music with their eyes closed, and it's just like, yeah.
Yeah, it's incredible. And, like, it really does have everything. It's got that sense of wonder, but also, I don't know about you, I was a massive Fraidy Cat when I was young, so that Velociraptor kitchen scene gave me nightmares.
Yeah, right there with you.
Yeah, just like the tapping on the... Oh, and I get it when I'm older, of course, but that scene where Lexi, I think is the girl's name, is hiding in the kitchen thing and she's trying to pull the oven door down. I'd never realized until I was older that she was actually in that the reflection was working. Somehow I missed that as a kid, but that was horrifying. When it was charging at her, I always just, you know, that sphincter closes right up. And it's just, it's fantastic. It really holds up now. What do you think, just, we won't get into too much of this, but what are your thoughts on 2 and 3?
I absolutely loved 2. So 2 remains, like, it's not as good as the first, but it still remains this film. I absolutely love the storyline. I love the actors. I thought that it tells an interesting story. I will admit, it gets a little off track when the T-Rex gets itself to land in New York, but that's still a great scene.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the missing dog, though, I remember rewatching that as an adult and being like, that is incredibly dark for a Jurassic Park movie, but all right.
Yeah. And generally in the first film, when the T-Rex first eats the lawyer's already been set up as this
bad guy, this, like, we don't care, yeah, like, he abandons the children, like, that's fine. And even the, like, clever girl,
yeah,
where he gets eaten by the raptor, there's enough build up to be like, you know what, he was kind of a dick to the raptors.
Yeah,
those are all adults, they're not children or pets.
Yeah. And in the second one, like, just random nice guys, like, they're just getting ripped apart. And then the woman in Jurassic World, who's done not really that much, she's a bit annoyed and short on patience, but she's saddled with these two kids that she doesn't know, and she gets viciously, like,
destroyed, torn apart, a horrible way, where, like, two different dinosaurs end up going after her, where not only does she have, like, the pterodactyl, but then the subaquatic, whatever that thing is.
Mosasaurus, I think it is. Yeah,
which, ugh. And then the third one, I actually have a soft spot in my heart for the third one.
Yeah.
Because I don't think it's as bad as, like, it's still dumb. But the dinosaurs are still great. I'm not against going back and visiting that world again. And to give the movies credit, each of the worlds does show an evolving ecosystem that basically says, fuck you, man, I'm going to grow up the way that I want to grow up.
Yeah.
And I think that's the part that I enjoy the most, is it's an ecologist paradise.
Yeah. I like the third one in that, like, you have... I know the Spinosaurus is kind of just another T-Rex, but... I don't really care too much. I think it leans too heavily on the raptors. I don't like that massive focus on the raptors. I love the pterosaurs in the third one. Anyway, but back to the first one. I mean, the use of CGI, it had never really been done before, like we've talked about. It kind of it revolutionized movies after it. Like, movies started, there was this huge period of, hey, we can do this. We shouldn't, but we can do this. Like, we watched the first Jumanji.
So good.
The other day, which, again, lots of CGI. CGI in that one does not hold up. Those monkeys look terrible.
Yeah.
But, I mean, they had a crack. They did use some practical effects as well, like that weird-ass pelican.
No, my partner and I recently rewatched Labyrinth.
Oh, yeah.
And the practical effects are all absolutely amazing, with the exception of they have the whole, like, the creatures that pop their heads off.
Yeah.
That I remember being terrified of when I was a kid, and rewatching it, the CGI is so bad. I hadn't realized that scene was CGI. And it honestly just takes away from that entire scene. I just cringed the entire time until it was over and we got back to the awesome other effects.
Yeah. It's hard going back to that sort of stuff. And this was one criticism of the new Jurassic World films, is that the CGI doesn't look that much better than it did 25 years ago.
No.
X, I'm hitting X, skip the story. X.
Drew, that's not a game, it's a movie.
What? Then why does it look like that? It looks so fake. It looked better in 93. Steven Spielberg must be rolling over in his grave.
He's not.
Hmm?
Never mind.
Anyway, so what we're going to talk about today, which I probably should have mentioned up top, we were going to go through kind of some of the big criticisms that lots of people make of these. So we'll talk a little bit about, the fact that there's almost no creatures from the Jurassic in here.
And we'll talk about some of the general criticisms that are associated with the dinosaurs, just some like basic stuff that everybody talks about. And Sam has some very entertaining stories about one of the paleontologists that was an inspiration for Sam Neill's character.
And we'll talk a little bit about the feathers debate, which has kind of become a bit widespread. Less widespread, but I still feel like some people know this, the whole thing about T-Rexes maybe being scavengers, that sort of stuff. We'll talk about the fact that velociraptors are tiny, and then get into like the nitty-gritty of kind of DNA recovery and that whole kind of process that they talk about in this movie. We'll talk about the lysine deficiency and kind of filling in the gaps, and then we will get into the second monstrous human of this, Michael Crichton. But before we get into some of the science behind the first Jurassic Park, if you've got any thoughts or questions about this or any other episode, you can find myself and Adam on Twitter. I'm at SamParentNTNU. Adam is at HarsikAdam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, our website is cinematicaanimalia.com, or you can email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. And if you want to hear about some of the more hardcore science that Adam and I write about, including some stuff that we're going to be referencing this week, specifically the recovery of ancient DNA, check out ecologyforthemasses.com.
Here's a little song I wrote to cheer you up. It's called Let's Go Already!
Okay, so, like I said, the first big thing with Jurassic Park is that most of these dinosaurs are from the Cretaceous.
Right, and so just as a quick overview, the Jurassic period is defined as a period approximately 200 million to 145, 146 million years ago, as opposed to the Cretaceous period is defined as a period approximately 66 million to 145 million years ago. And that's a big gap.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's easy enough to throw those two numbers out and be like, oh, like, what is time? But hundreds of millions of years, like that's a big span of time to be like, we're going to pick these animals from this versus this.
You compare it to how long Homo sapiens have been around.
Right. It's a movie starring Neanderthals versus Homo sapiens and being like, it's fine. It's the same thing.
I think, for example, I think Homo erectus died out roughly 2 million years ago. That's like two species before us.
Right.
Since then, Homo neanderthalensis has died out and we've become the dominant species. That's 2 million years. This is a gap of like 80 million years. So... yeah. Look, do you think, because I mean, the Jurassic has kind of become synonymous with Jurassic Park. These weren't, you know, huge words that everyone knew back then. Do you think had they called it Cretaceous Park, it would have done as well?
I don't think so. I think that human beings are stupid creatures, and I like the way that Jurassic Park sounds better than Cretaceous Park.
I guess, but is that just because we grew up with the concept of Jurassic Park?
Maybe.
Is it so ingrained into us that we think Jurassic sounds cooler than Cretaceous?
Like, I was listening to this podcast that I enjoy recently, that there are actually people that companies hire that help choose the numbers that they use with their products. So, like,
okay.
KFC has just 11 herbs and spices, right?
Yeah. By the way, if you go to KFC's Twitter account, they follow six guys called Herb and the five spice girls.
Yeah. The first guy who figured that out actually had this portrait of him commissioned, and it's a portrait of him and the Colonel. He was the first one who pointed this out on Twitter, which is super cool.
Nice.
But they discussed like 10 is a solid number. It's a scientific number. But 11 is almost a mystical number because it's one past 10.
Okay.
And that it's something like 66% of the world population feels that 7 is their favorite number.
Really?
And I'm 7 is a great number. That's why we have lucky number 7. But they were discussing from a marketing perspective, attaching certain numbers to certain products, whether or not you're trying to advertise that something is scientific or whether or not you're trying to advertise that something is mystical, choosing certain numbers to go with it. Like people believe that 4 is a strong scientific number, that 10 is a strong scientific number. I think that human beings, myself included, are weird animals.
Yeah.
That I will go to see a film called The Jurassic Park. I don't know if I'd go to see a film called Cretaceous Park.
It does have more of an info documentary vibe, doesn't it?
Right?
What's that? What's it called when you have like a learning kids show? Like what Magic School Bus was. Infotainment.
Right.
Yeah, okay, fair. Look, I'm just looking up Jurassic Park name choice to see if there's a rationale behind it. As much as it might not seem like it, I also do research sometimes for this podcast. not quite as in depth as Dave does, but I can't find anything. Can't find anything in here in terms of name choice.
So the Tyrannosaurus Rex, the Triceratops, the Velociraptor, these are all residents of the Cretaceous period, not the Jurassic.
Yeah.
Now there are Jurassic creatures in there, so the Stegosaurus, the Pterodactyl, and the Allosaurus, who I do believe shows up at one area. I can't remember. It's in one of the movies.
You're right. There is an Allosaurus in there somewhere.
I think it's the third one. There are Jurassic animals in it.
Yeah.
But it's not just Jurassic Park. And that's great. I'm happy to knock that up as a marketing name, because I can also see, what's the name of the guy who creates the park? Hammond.
John Hammond, yeah.
Sitting down and, you know, having this discussion, and one of those weasel-faced lawyers that gets eaten on the toilet standing up and going, marketing has tested and found that Jurassic Park actually has a better finding than Cretaceous Park.
Yeah.
And him just being like, fuck it, I don't care. I just want people to come to the park. Sure.
Yeah.
Let's call it Jurassic Park.
And that's the thing. Whatever marketing department Spielberg had to choose the name Jurassic Park, guarantee that if John Hammond was alive and that was a thing, his marketing department would have been way larger.
Yeah.
And we'll get into this next week. One of the biggest problems that a lot of ecologists have is that we just kind of say, okay, well, you know, you can't do this even because, you know, it's going to be bad for the environment. But you actually do have to take into account economic issues, like people's day-to-day lives.
Yeah.
And of course, a lawyer is going to see that and be like, okay, this is going to make billions of dollars. How do we market this?
Yeah.
And I hate to say this, but all the paleontologists are going to be like, this is going ahead, whether you like it or not.
And Sam and I are going to get into this a little bit, but most paleontologists will say that they have their problems with Jurassic Park, but the amount of money and research and extra young people that join paleontology because they saw this film as a kid,
yeah,
is something that every scientist who's like, well, I may have problems with the film, but I would never in a million years change anything about it.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't undo what it's done for us.
Yeah. See, so for instance, Friends, right? Friends started, I think maybe a year or two before this came out. When was the first season of Friends? 91, 92?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
But regardless, like, Ross back then, massive dork, right? As an adult studying dinosaurs. Because, you know, it was like a nerdy thing. It wasn't like a popular thing at all. This turned dinosaurs into something that wasn't just like a weird old man's hobby. All of a sudden, kids all over the world were like, yeah, fantastic dinosaurs. And adults found them fascinating as well. Like,
yeah.
There's so many paleontologists out there, and there's a lot of people who've spoken about the fact that, yeah, Jurassic Park got a whole wave of paleontologists into the discipline. Same as David Attenborough did for our discipline.
And eventually the rhino went backwards and retreated. I mean, it almost destroyed the Land Rover, and all we did was to sit there. And if you'd gone out, that would have been dangerous. But as it was, I just hoped that the people who built the Land Rover had done all the nuts up. So.
Anyway, we should move on. So the feathers thing.
Mm.
How do you feel about this in the new films? Dinosaurs still not having feathers, despite the fact that we know they did. And we can even actually, at this point, figure out some of the colours that the feathers were.
Really? I guess we can find pigments.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. I think dinosaurs look really dumb with feathers, but maybe that's just because I grew up with Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
So I don't, again, I'm not blaming any marketing team for selling pictures of dinosaurs that people are going to be more scared of and go to see, because lizards are scarier than birds, with the exception of emus. Fuck emus, they're terrifying.
Yeah, they really are. There's an enclosure down on Port Phillip Island, which is about 2 or 3 hours from where I grew up.
Okay.
And there's this... It's an enormous thing. Grey kangaroos, eastern grey kangaroos, are kind of free ranging around the whole sanctuary that you walk around. They can come up to you at any point. But there's this area down the back that they've got gated off, and it's gated off because that's where the emus are. And emus terrify people. Like, so normally when the you hold your hand out with some like pellets on it to a kangaroo will come over and nibble it a bit. Maybe they'll give you a bit of a nip accidentally. An emu will just come up and take the entire thing by just throwing its face at your hand. They are, and they do not leave you alone. Like, the kangaroos will wait till your hands are down there. The emus will just be going into your pockets. really, like, just trying to rob the shit out of your hand. They're horrifying.
This better work, boy. I don't want to wind up working on your mother's emu farm.
Anyway, sorry, sidetracked.
I know that almost all of the research has come back that suggests that a lot of these dinosaurs are going to have feathers. I worry that they would just look like big chickens.
Yeah.
They don't look as terrifying with the feathers, and I understand they're still scary, and maybe that's just because we grew up with Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
And I don't believe the research was it out at that point when these books were written and the movie came out that in fact they had feathers, or was that a later discovery?
No, so we should definitely talk about this. Before this film, the birds-dinosaurs link was kind of tenuous.
Okay.
But Jack Horner, who, like, we'll talk about later, was one of the big kind of proponents of this idea that birds and dinosaurs were closely linked. And we now know that birds evolved from dinosaurs. Birds are dinosaurs in the same way that primates are mammals. It helps to distinguish us from the rest of the mammals, even though we definitely are mammals. Adam's talked about this before. Birds are technically reptiles, yes. It's useful to teach them as different groups because it helps, you know, kids with the whole concept of identification taxonomy.
Mm.
But in the same way that birds are reptiles, birds are definitely dinosaurs. I mean, dinosaurs are just, you know, a type of reptile. So,
right.
Yeah. I mean, this is kind of weird to think about. But for instance, the Mosasaurus, who you see in Jurassic World, and the Pterosaurs, who you see in Jurassic Park 3, both of them are not dinosaurs. But that crow outside your window is. So before that link wasn't 100% there. But afterwards, like in the years since then, 27 years, that's been kind of conclusively confirmed.
I don't blame the modern films of Chris Pratt for keeping the dinosaurs without wings, because if anything, they're just staying true to the original films.
Yeah. And B.D. Wong's character, Henry Wu, I think the name is.
Yeah.
So he has a great throwaway line in Jurassic World, which basically says, none of these creatures look the way they really would have lived back then. We've put in so much DNA from different species. And he's got that throwaway line. And as soon as I heard that, I was like, yep, I'm fine with that.
Cool.
The other thing is, this is actually mentioned in the film when they're standing atop that ridge and there's that great line about like birds evading a predator. So that was a line that was directly inspired by Jack Horner.
Cool.
And there's a fantastic story that I've seen on, you know, those Tumblr posts that crop up on your Facebook. But it's this story about how when people like Jack Horner were working on the film with Steven Spielberg, they had access to this CGI technology, which they would have never got funding for back at their home institutes. But as they were working on consultants for this, you know, $100 million movie, they had all this amazing technology and they were able to kind of like reconstruct how a dinosaur may have moved based on the skeleton. And it ended up being so much like a chicken's, essentially, or an ostrich's. It improved our knowledge. Now, this is a fantastic story, and I would totally believe it, but I can't find any sources online confirming it.
Except for Tumblr,
yeah. Ugh. If you are that Tumblr person who posted that thing and you have sources, please send them to us, because I really want that to be true.
But no Sonic pictures, please.
Yeah, no, please no.
Tumblr's a vibrant space for artists, comedians, young activists, and the many non-pornographic communities that make up our platform. What am I looking at here, Carm? Because that, conservatively, what percentage of our platform is porn? 90?
But anyway, while we're here, velociraptors.
Right. This seems like it's a pretty well-known fact, but for anyone who doesn't know, the velociraptor, they're tiny.
Yeah, they are like 3 feet tall.
Which are still terrifying. The beginning of the second Jurassic Park, where the little girl walks into the woods and then there's all those little like dinosaurs that come running after her.
Compi something or other. They're called compies in the movie.
They're a great example of super small little creatures running after you are still great. I mean, I love the Velociraptor, but it does not look anything like that.
Yeah.
And there is a larger subspecies of the Velociraptor, but it's still not that big.
Yeah. If you get enough of them, they're still terrifying. There are plenty of predatory animals out there that aren't a threat by themselves, but you put three or four of them in a room and, yeah.
The scariest thing in all of the Zelda games are chickens.
Really?
Yeah. Anyway, I still love the big Velociraptor, just know that it's not actually Velociraptors that you're looking at.
Yeah, so they were heavily inspired at the time by Deinonychus, particularly that enormous front claw.
Yeah.
So Deinonychus was thought at the time to be a species of Velociraptor. And they've since been able to tell that that's not actually the case. They're a completely different, I don't know if it's a family or a different genus, but they're not closely related. The other species that it is quite similar to is a Utah raptor, which is a species that, you know, as you can probably figure out, was found in America, the late Cretaceous. So again, just before dinosaurs got wiped out. Again, they're a little bit smaller than velociraptors. And just as an interesting side note, Steven Spielberg wanted the velociraptors to be 10 feet tall. So that's a bit over 3 meters tall. That's really towering over people.
Okay, so clearly some people stepped in and turned that man down.
Yeah, and there were changes made to the velociraptors. So there was a guy who was working on the film, I think his last name was Tippett, and he wanted, I think, the velociraptors to have like forked tongues flicking in and out. And this is another point at which Jack Horner kind of stepped in and said, no, you can't do that, that's ridiculous. Dinosaurs are birds, they're not lizards.
Cool.
Like you said before, it doesn't bother me too much that they've made these changes.
No.
Because it's pretty widespread knowledge at the moment that that's not what velociraptors look like. But it's okay. Velociraptors, velociraptors, don't get too close, if people stop snapping. When it comes to dinosaurs, we are small. 6 feet long and 3 feet tall. But our size doesn't matter at all. We're quick and speedy when it's time to crawl. Yeah, the T-Rex. So, this is another thing that's been... And this is Jack Horner's fault, actually.
Really?
Well, I mean, I'm pretty sure he was one of the people who published a paper that said the T-Rex was exclusively a scavenger.
Well, not just the scavenger. I was going to talk about the vision thing.
Yeah, let's talk about the whole vision first. Because we didn't bring this up at the start, but it's made a big point of in the film that the T-Rex vision is based on movement, so it can't see you if you don't move around.
Right, which there's no credence. They've actually done CAT scans of the skull and done 3D models where they've been able to basically recreate areas of the brain. And of course, you can't 100% say based on the creation of the model that these areas of the brain are going to relate to these areas. But based on evolutionary pathways and similarity to modern day reptiles and birds, they're in a pretty good position to just say, hey guys, it looks like they would have had a great sense of smell, a great sense of hearing, and they would have had really sharp eyes. There's no reason for them to be a species that only sees movement. That's a dumb mechanism.
Yeah.
If you've ever freaked out a rabbit before and you've seen the first thing it does is it just freezes. If the T-Rex walks through and everything just evolutionarily learns to freeze, T-Rex won't starve.
Yeah. When I was tracking moose back 4 years ago now, the first thing that they will do, they will go really still. They will turn their head slightly, but the ears will just like kind of switch towards you. So they'll be really still, but the ears will rotate so that they know exactly what's going on.
Ugh.
Yeah, so I mean, there's no way that a predator is going to survive if it can't see anything if it's not moving.
No. So super cool idea. This is something that I do kind of fault the creators for, because there was enough research that was out at that point that basically said, like, hey, this doesn't make sense. There doesn't really appear to be anyone who was saying, hey, we don't think that that the T-Rex could track something unless it was moving.
Yeah.
So the inclusion in the film, I don't actually find it adds that much to the film. It does create that absolutely great scene, but it would have just been as useful if they said they didn't have great low light detection or they were still not figuring out vehicles because they didn't understand how the cars worked. Again, I will never get mad at anything that Jurassic Park did for everything that it's inspired, and it's still one of my favorite films, but there was no credence to that idea.
Yeah. And I mean, I feel like you could have just done as much with having the T-Rex think they're a part of the car or something.
Right, and not understanding cars.
Yeah, it really kind of, there's a joke in the third film, I think, where he's like, everyone's standing completely still and they all just bolt, but it's not a particularly funny joke. Like, it's just, I don't know.
It's okay, it's dead. Nobody move a muscle.
And Sam, I think the other section that you wanted to discuss with the T-Rex was the claim that they're a scavenger.
Yeah, so like we said before, Jack Horner has since come out. He had a paper, I think, around the same time that suggested the T-Rex was a scavenger. Because we now know that the T-Rex would not, just because of all that bulk, wouldn't have been able to move that fast. So maybe it was an ambush predator, but they have confirmed that it was a hunter. So potentially it did scavenge. I mean, when you are that big, you can just rock up to any old other carnivore's kill and claim it. So cheetahs are incredibly fast, but they're really kind of weak, which is why it always takes like two or three of them to bring prey down. If a lion rocks up to a cheetah's kill, then the cheetah's losing its kill.
If hyenas rock up to a cheetah's kill, the cheetah's probably going to have to ditch.
Yeah. Cheetahs lose kills all the time. They put so much effort into bringing something down. And then all that needs to happen is a lion or a hyena comes along and, yeah, they've lost it. So a T-Rex, I mean, if velociraptors bring something down and the T-Rex rocks up, yeah, then they're not going to fight. I mean, we see that in the very first film and again in the second one. Like, I think the only reason that the raptors are fighting is because they are directly threatened. They can't get out of this at all. If the T-Rex rocked up, the raptors would just flee straight away. But it sounds weird me saying that because, you know, they've confirmed that T-Rexes were hunters. So how they've done this is that they've found teeth marks on herbivores. They've found tooth marks on their skeletons that have since healed over. And so that indicates that the T-Rex has attacked it, taken a chomp out of it, and the hadrosaurs escaped. This couldn't have happened any other way.
Yeah, it's the same way as like modern day scientists have done a lot of Neanderthal research and have found evidence that they find fractures in the bone that have healed.
Yeah.
And in many cases, they find fractures that are associated with serious traumatic injuries, like falling and breaking both of your legs.
Yeah.
Which supports the idea that Neanderthals actually took care of each other in a tribe basis, that there would be some that would be feeding others, because that's the only way that these animals could have survived long enough for those wounds to have healed.
Yes. We should also say, though, that we now know from isotope analysis that Neanderthals were also cannibals.
Oh.
Yeah, they were obligate carnivores, so like 80% of their diet was meat.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, they would often cannibalize.
Okay.
We should talk about this, the CAT scan stuff, the brain stuff we're talking about with the T-Rex. One of the best examples of stuff we know about Neanderthals comes from the fact that we know they had larger brains than Homo sapiens do, but from CAT scans, we also know that the part of their brain that's associated with vision was much, much larger, which is why we think they lived in caves, because, you know, you need better vision if you're hanging out in caves all the time. They're thought to be massive competitors with these huge cave hyenas that used to exist in Europe called Pachycruta. Because the Pachycruta, like their population started to wane after Neanderthals migrated up into Europe.
Super cool.
Did he just call me chubby? Uh-oh. It sounded a lot like he just said chubby, which would be a mistake because I will not be made to feel ashamed of who I am.
Oh, boy.
I may run from hyenas, but I will always fight a bully!
You feel better, Pumbaa?
I do.
You got that out of your system?
I did.
And then Sam kind of wanted to talk about, and I think is a good point here, is that the T-Rex roars while chasing things. And we've discussed this before, but Sam,
we have, yeah, I think we talked about it when we actually did the best and worst movie scientist.
It does not make sense to chase something and yell at it the entire time.
Yeah.
Or to vocalize before you start chasing.
Yeah,
letting your prey get a head start. Like, the cheetah doesn't stand up and roar before it goes after its prey. If you've ever seen it take down a gazelle, it is super quiet up until the gazelle starts to run, and then it just books it.
Yeah, and it's also like you have to put effort in. Have you ever tried talking while jogging? It's a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
You don't want to waste that energy. But, okay, so here's my one concession. And this is something we should get into, the fact that these dinosaurs are on an island and they have, you know, just been bred from nothing. So they're potentially not exhibiting normal behavior. And potentially the T-Rex isn't actually hunting that Jeep. I don't know. Maybe it's like it's trying to chase us off its land because it sees it as a threat. But then why is it chasing it so
actively? Right. The only thing that I could find, and I couldn't find a lot of information supporting it, was the concept that maybe the T-Rex is roaring to scare off other scavengers that might be coming.
Yeah. So it doesn't have to hunt or fight.
Exactly. But then again, roaring simply alerts other things in the area, potentially, that you have something.
Yeah.
It's not going to necessarily scare off. It might just summon other animals to come and try to steal your kill.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Gorillas do it. A lot of primates do it, like, you know, screeching to ward off other things. But Yeah, I can't see a big dinosaur doing it.
Stay back, I got a chainsaw.
Yeah, so those are our general, these have been talked about before, lots of people have acknowledged them, and kind of fall into the paleontology category. And so this is something that isn't, at least I didn't think it was that well known. Sam has been sharing these stories with me and absolutely horrifying me.
Yeah.
But Sam, do you want to tell us about Jack Horner?
Yeah, so we've been talking about this guy a lot because he was very influential. He actually spent a lot of time with Sam Neill in the run-up to the filming of Jurassic Park. So this guy got forced out of his job 4 years ago as a 70-year-old because he was dating a 19-year-old student at his university in the University of Montana. So his first wife was also a student of his that he met also when he was much older. The guy's kind of gross. Like, one of his defenses was that, you know, hey, she's a 19-year-old student, but she's not my student. She's not in any of my classes.
Oh, she's not my 19-year-old student. Ew.
Yeah, are you really clutching at straws there, man?
They're going to fire you. You can't date a student. It's against the rules.
Really? It's not just frowned upon?
Anyway, that's Jack Horner. He just also, look, two sides to every story, whatever, but he just looks like a creep.
God, the day that whatever controversy Kurt Russell or Tom Hanks is involved in, it comes out and steals from me my last remaining heroes, my heart will break.
What can you do? Anyway, on to DNA recovery, which is kind of a huge, big, you know, obviously one of the central themes of this thing.
Yeah, so we're going to talk a little bit about, because this is more in my wheelhouse, so just as a preface, before I became a veterinarian, as a research student, I did a large amount of RNA and DNA recovery work. Not such a big part of my day-to-day now, which is fantastic, but something that back in the day I did enjoy. In the movie, the DNA comes from these amber-tracked insects. There's a whole great explanation from Genie or Splicey or whatever they call that weird little genetic cartoon that discusses you've got these insects that feed off of the dinosaurs, so basically parasitic insects,
yep,
that then became wrapped in amber, that these are incredibly rare, but that Hammond has set up a number of mines where they've been digging for these, and that from these they've managed to recover DNA that is damaged, and then they've been able to fill it in using frog DNA.
They extract the preserved blood from the mosquito and, bingo, dino DNA.
This isn't a thing. So this idea, interestingly enough, originally came from an entomologist in 1982. This researcher, his name was George Pinar Jr., and his colleagues actually were examining a fossil fly that they found in amber. They were like, hey, this is around 40 million years old. And they suggested that it might be, you know, this extreme form of mummification. And he made a general statement with a colleague that basically said, hey, we might be able to extract DNA from this. Now, they had published this discussion. Michael Crichton had apparently read this and actually flew out and talked with them. So DNA stands for deoxyribonucleic acid. And DNA, at least for us, and again, I'm not going to get into the differences that are associated with certain organisms or RNA substitutes, but the big thing you have to know is that DNA is made up at a base of these four different compounds, cytosine, guanine, adenine, and thymine. And that there's also a sugar called deoxyribose, and then there's a phosphate group. And so that kind of sticks all of these things together, and it creates this code that when typed out in things called codons, leads to instructions where basically the cell can read this information and decide how to make proteins. This is very, very simplified. Now, DNA is relatively stable. It's not that stable. So we have lots of fossil findings today. And paleontologists actually have taken these resin balls and looked at trying to extract DNA from them. And it's not something that you can get from amber. So one, amber is very, very rare. Like they talk about this a little bit in Jurassic Park, but if we were to collect all the amber in the world and you were actually able to find enough that connected to, let's say, a Tyrannosaurus, you would be unlikely if you piled up all the amber to actually get enough genetic material to make up a single T-Rex. even if you were to piece this stuff together and stick frog material in between. Like, there's just, the degradation would be too bad. And what I mean by that is that DNA breaks down over time. So most research has come out that suggests that DNA has a half-life of approximately 521 years. What this means is that all samples of DNA would potentially be destroyed within a period of 6.8 million years after an organism died, in the best case scenario. There really wouldn't be any way of actually extracting, collecting, and redoing this DNA, because none of it would be around in amber.
This is the least scientific thing I've ever seen!
You be quiet!
Now, I know there are going to be some people that are going to say, well, we do have some species out there that, you know, we've collected DNA from. How did that work? Well, the woolly mammoth, perfect example, is only about 10,000 years old. And yeah, we have been doing a whole bunch of research to try and like sequence their DNA and then theoretically splice those genes into the DNA of an Asian elephant in order to produce this hybrid that they're calling a mammalphant. But one, you're splicing into a very, very similar organism. And two, it's only a 10,000 year time span. And the same thing goes for, we've done a lot of DNA research on Neanderthals. Again, the earliest samples are only 38,000 years old. And the one of the oldest samples that we do have is, we've got one, a genome belonging to a girl, an early Homo sapien, who died approximately 80,000 years ago. And then they have actually been able to sequence an entire DNA system for an extinct horse that was approximately 700,000 years old.
At the moment, we've got the whole genome for Neanderthals. We've been able to sequence the whole genome for mammoths, like Dave said, and we've also been able to do it for the dodo.
Oh, cool.
The term ancient DNA, actually, like, it was first coined from Neanderthal DNA. Ancient DNA is typically DNA that has been fragmented and broken down a lot. Having said that, it's a bit of a misnomer. So there's herbarium specimens, herbarium specimens being plants, that are only decades old that already show that level of degradation. So, I mean, mammoths and Neanderthals, the stuff we've got on them, it's amazing that we've been able to do that sort of stuff.
Sam just touched on a very useful point. We didn't collect these samples from the Neanderthals, from the ancient horses, from the mammoths, from amber. We've collected these actually from their bodies that have often been preserved in frozen states, so found in areas where thaws never occur.
Yep.
So high altitude regions where these animals might have struggled or found themselves higher up, or in areas where the tissue has been preserved in things like peat moss that have stopped degradation or inhibited breakdown and kept them in kind of a frozen preserved state. We haven't found them in this dried out old amber buried underneath a ton of rock that's been fossilized.
And I mean, the other thing is that these genomes that we've been able to sequence, they're not from like one individual. They're from tons of different specimens that we've got. The big one that Dave's been talking about is fragmentation. But another problem with that ADNA is actual chemical modification, which can often occur at the end of these fragments. So what happens is bases can actually switch. So you've probably heard of the whole GATC thing. You have either a GC combination or an AT combination. Often C to T transitions will occur just out of nowhere. And so we don't know whether that T that we're looking at is an original T or if it's just switched over from something.
Correct.
I should say, I want to credit Vanessa Beaker on this. She's one of my colleagues. She put together this huge article on this sort of stuff. She works with genomics at the museum I work at.
Cool.
She's much more knowledgeable about this sort of stuff. Vanessa, if you're listening, I hope I have not butchered any of the stuff you wrote down. But anyway, the other thing that the Vanessa relayed to me, and you should look this article up because she's done a really good job. It's called The Revolutionary Headache of Ancient DNA. The best conditions for preserving DNA are cold and dry conditions. These specimens that you can all see in the film are living in a tropical rainforest. It's not going to help at all.
Like, no.
And when they roamed the Earth, the temperatures were much more stable across the entire planet. The best specimens we have are ice age specimens. I mean,
mm-hmm. Things that froze, exactly.
It's not going to happen for dinosaurs, yeah.
This is our private stockpile for the ice age. Subarctic temperatures will force us underground for a billion, billion years.
So you got 3 melons?
If you weren't smart enough to plan ahead, then doom on you!
Get away from me.
So, the next area that we're going to quickly talk about is, having said that you can't find this dinosaur DNA and actually reconstruct a dinosaur, is there any modern way at which you could basically build a dinosaur, not from scratch, but
again, these are just articles that I've read from geneticists, and I want to point out that geneticists, not paleontologists. So some of you might have seen the example that Dave just brought up, the mammoth ant thing. That's one way you can recreate an old species. And again, you're not recreating that species, you are editing a modern species to kind of look like it. And this is a thing that occurs today. I mean, people might have heard of the animal the quagga. It's essentially a subspecies of zebra that went extinct a long time ago. But it is quite easy to recreate this, at least from a physiological perspective, something that looks like it, because it just kind of looks like a zebra with slightly different stripes. The back half is kind of more brown. I mean, you could just, you know, put some zebras and donkeys together and hey presto, you've got something that looks quite similar. Is that recreating it? I don't know. But the same thing has been said about dinosaurs, because there have been certain labs that have gone about not creating dinosaurs this way, but editing bird DNA to create something that looks more like a dinosaur. That's being done. This sort of technology increases exponentially, which is worrying, which that's something we'll get into next week, and Michael Crichton felt very strongly about. Because I do actually believe that they'll be able to recreate something that looks, not something that is, but something that looks kind of Velociraptor-like.
Yeah, 100%.
You take a roadrunner, make it a little bigger.
Take a fucking emu, attach some front limbs onto that bastard and shorten the neck, and I will be just as equally terrified.
Yeah.
And a featherless emu running at me? That's a nightmare. I just lie down and cry.
There is this species of dinosaur that basically looks just like a seagull with teeth. Ichthyornis.
No, zero stars.
All you got to do is give a seagull teeth. Not a smart idea, but also not that hard to do. Those sort of developments. I mean, how long has it been since we could put an ear on a mouse?
Not that long.
Yeah.
The problem is that we're rapidly advancing.
Yeah.
Right? We're finding ourselves into science fiction territory very, very rapidly.
So look, my understanding of this isn't perfect, but I do genuinely believe that within maybe, let's say, 20 years, they will be able to make something that looks like a Velociraptor. Whether or not that's a good idea is another question. But again, we can get more into that kind of concept of a repopulation or rewilding of dinosaurs next week.
You cloned yourself? So he's an exact copy of you? Well, not exact. I have to remain superior, so I bred out some of the intelligence, made him sort of a simpleton, you know. I call him Bitch Stewie.
The other problem that is constantly brought up, and it's something that Adam specifically wanted me to focus on, is the concept of the lysine deficiency, or as they call it in the film, which is a great name, the lysine contingency.
Yeah.
So Dr. Wu makes a point in the movie that all of the dinosaurs in the film have been modified such that they do not have the ability to produce lysine. This has forced the dinosaurs to depend on lysine supplements provided by the park's veterinary staff, and in this way the dinosaurs can never escape from the park because they would never survive long without these supplements.
Yeah.
The lysine contingency is intended to prevent dinosaurs from damaging the global ecosystem. Lysine is already an essential amino acid. All vertebrates do not have the ability to produce lysine. All vertebrates need lysine. You don't need to build a gene weakness in for this. We need it. We need to get it from external sources. So, as a quick side note, where do humans get it from? Well, meat and dairy, chickens, cheese, beef. Anything that we're eating is probably going to have lysine if it's another organism. But let's say, ooh, well, what do you do about the dinosaurs? Where are they going to get their lysine from? Literally anywhere. So humans, if we're vegetarians, soybeans, avocados, mangoes, beets, leeks, tomatoes, pears, green peppers, potatoes, all contain lysine, and those are just lysine-rich foods. So the dinosaurs eating those plants, they're going to find lysine.
Yeah.
I'm not worried about them finding lysine. Now, non-essential amino acids, things that we actually have to make, there are a ton of these. There are 12 non-essential amino acids. So of the standard amino acids we need, the 20, only 8 are essential that we need to get from our food sources. And for some reason, Crichton decided to pick, so statistically, if he had lined up all the amino acids on a board and whipped a dart at them, he would have been more likely to have hit a non-essential amino acid than to have hit an essential amino acid that he could have knocked out of their genome. So I'm not going to get into all of them, but you know what? Actually, I will. Alanine, aspergine, asparate, cysteine, glutamine, glycine, proline, serine, tyrosine, arginine, and histidine. Michael Crichton, if you are listening from the grave, those are the amino acids that you should have chose that you could have knocked out.
Wow, Ron Moore, creator of Battlestar Galactica.
How about letting us come aboard and help you with your whip-smart plots?
Help? Why would I need help writing plots? I just throw a dart at the cast list and boom, they're a Cylon. Rinse, repeat, cash the f***ing check. Watch. Shapong, shapong, shaping. Cylon. Oh, please help me. This is so hard.
But yeah, I think that's all we want to do for this week. Next week, I'll go through kind of the history of dinosaurs in film, because man, if you think you know all the dinosaur films out there, you do not. And then we will talk about the splicing of DNA from frogs and whatever it's a real mixed bag, and it's a real bad trope of these movies. And then we'll also talk a little bit about more the ethics, kind of functional extinction, what the point would be of bringing dinosaurs back and why it's probably not a good idea. And we'll just go through how good some of these scientists are as well. PSA?
Okay, so just as a quick veterinary PSA, just because it's something I've seen a couple of times this week. So we spend a lot of time talking with people about their dogs. If they've eaten something like a rubber ball or a bone or something like that, that has become stuck somewhere in the intestines or is blocking the flow through the stomach. And as a result, your dog is vomiting and it's a little bit of a problem. Now, one of the obstructions we don't spend that much time talking about, but is seen occasionally, is something called an esophageal foreign body. So if you feed your dog a bone or some other object that potentially gets itself stuck somewhere along the esophagus, it can create this really serious problem where now material can potentially move around the esophagus and potentially fall through. So your dog might be intermittently vomiting or sort of coughing constantly like it's trying to bring something up. But the object actually isn't stuck in the stomach, it's stuck just above the stomach, in the tube that carries food from your mouth to your stomach. And here's the problem. The longer that object is in place, the greater the risk of something called pressure necrosis, where that object actually pushes against the walls of the esophagus, and the esophagus actually starts to die underneath that pressure. And it can start to die within a couple of hours, and you can start to experience these deep ulcerations. Now, the only way to get that object out once it's stuck there is one, to go into a specialty hospital and have someone with a scope actually go in and try to pull that object out or push that object into the stomach, or have a surgeon come in and either try to pull that object through from the stomach down, or actually go into the chest through an incredibly complicated procedure, something called thoracotomy. But here's the kicker. Your esophagus doesn't heal well. When it's damaged, and if it actually is permeated, it's very difficult to stitch back together because muscle does not like to be stitched. And then on top of that, since your esophagus is a tube made of muscle that carries food to your stomach, if it becomes ripped or ruptured and it heals, it can form something called an esophageal stricture, which is an area of reduced diameter, basically a scar, which means that the next time that your animal eats, food running along that tube can now get stuck at that spot where basically it's smaller and it's scarred. So this is a serious problem. If you think that your dog might have eaten a bone or other material that has stuck somewhere along there, this needs to see a veterinarian immediately because one, there's no guarantee that we're actually going to be able to remove it. And two, even if we do remove it, your dog might die anyway. And if it's just left there, it will eventually rupture through the esophagus into the dog's chest. I wouldn't be bringing this issue up unless I had seen it a couple times this week. The ones that I got to see this week had happy endings, but some of the ones that I've seen in the past, if that bone has been in there for a couple of days, it doesn't usually have a happy ending.
And that is my least favorite vets PSA you've ever given. That was horrifying.
Sorry.
God damn.
They suck.
It's fine. I mean, it's important, but... Whew. Anyway, on that note, come back next week.
Yeah, we'll look at the rest of the dinosaur stuff and we'll get to spend some more time with Adam next week. But in the meantime...
If you like the episode, tell your friends about it, share it with your mates online, give us a like, leave us a review. And as we always say, the monsters aren't, well, I guess the monsters are real this week because birds are a thing.
Monsters are real, but the science isn't.
So, yes, that's it. Yeah, okay. Nice little reverse this week. All right. Bye, everyone.
Bye, guys.
Welcome to Jurassic Park.
We've made living biological attractions so astounding that they'll capture the imagination of the entire planet.
The most phenomenal discovery of our time.
How'd you do this?
Becomes the greatest adventure of all time.
Hold on to your butts.
Jurassic Park.